Good morning, Jonathan.
And good morning, Patrick.
Actually, it's evening for us.
Good morning, Jonathan.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
We're having a little bit of fun because we have with us tonight Jonathan Strawn. Hi, Jonathan. How are you?
I'm well, John. Yourself?
This is Patrick.
Oh, Patrick, sorry.
That's okay.
Gotta watch the little pictures. Gosh,
that's okay.
That was damage.
That's okay.
Rookie move.
So you have done quite a bit of things. I was looking at your bio, and I didn't even know where to start. You're an author. You're an editor. You have done stuff for Locus. You've got the notes from the Cood Street podcast. Is that Cood Street?
The Cood Street podcast.
Yes.
Yeah.
You have all sorts of things. I honestly don't know where to start.
Pick somewhere. Doesn't really matter where. I'm happy to, you know.
I got a place to start. Just this year alone, you've got four anthologies in print. Is that right? It started with Engineering Infinity. It was January?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. So, I had four books out. Engineering Infinity in January. Then it was followed by The Latest Best of the Year. Then Life on Mars just came out about a week or two ago. And Eclipse 4 is just out this week, I think. Yeah. So, four.
So where do you find the time? It's just an amazing,
you know. Well, some of it is, I mean, things slip over time. You know, that things don't always get published at the time you work on them. I mean, I had one book that was delayed a year and a half after I'd worked on it, so that made things look a little bit busier than they were. And in other times, sort of, I've learned quick ways to do things as best as I reasonably can. And also, I mean, like, I read in the morning before I go to work. I read in my lunch break at work. I do work in the evenings and on the weekends. And so you make it all fit, though I am trying to slow down.
So how do you actually approach an anthology? Do you have, like, a certain strategy or things you want to hit? I guess it depends on whether it's themed or not. But can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, you're right to say that it really does depend on the book you're trying to do. When I approach, say, something like The Year's Best, it's now something I've been doing for a while, and that really has its own form. I'm trying to just sort of survey the field, bring in what I think is particularly good, find a balance in the book. When I'm approaching something like Eclipse, which is on-themed, I don't have a set kind of approach to it other than to bring the reading that I've had in The Year's Best into the book as best I can, you know, to sort of, I try and use reading for The Year's Best as a barometer. And if people are starting to write stories that look really interesting, then I want to try to bring them in if I can and make that book its own thing. And it sort of moved in a direction I'd not anticipated and has its own character now, which I'm really happy about. When it comes to an original book, a themed book, like, say, the Starry Rift book that I did, or the Swords and Sorcery book or something, there you're surveying people, just, you know, that you might invite to see who would have something interesting to say on the subject, and then trying to get an array of stories so that they're not samey, so that you've got something that's the heart of the topic, you've got stuff that's out to either side of it, and you're going to give the reader a really kind of, hopefully, rich and varied experience when you're doing it. But it all starts with the original anthologies, with being aware of who's writing, inviting them, seeing if they'll be involved, and bringing that in, so that you know you can do something interesting, hopefully.
Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, what's the genesis for you of a anthology? I mean, where do you start? What gets that? Oh gosh, I need to do a Sword and Sorcery anthology with Lou Anders.
Well, Swords and Dark Magic was a funny one because I'd been aware of a couple of writers out there who had written something that was, seemed a bit new and fresh. I mean, I remember first reading Joe Abercrombie, and I was well aware of, say, Steve Erickson. And quite some years ago, I thought, you know, there is something happening in Swords and Sorcery, and it's well worth, you know, there's a book here. I began to feel a bit excited about reading the next Sword and Sorcery book. And in fact, now that I think about it, it may even have been the Richard Morgan novel that came out a few years back. The Steel Remains. I remember really loving the book and thinking, I really want to do a book that has some of the essence of this in it. And then I was at a World Fantasy, and I was sitting in a bar talking to Lou, and he was saying, I want to do a Swords and Sorcery book. And he goes, I want to do a Swords and Sorcery book too. I'm going, well, I don't want to go up against you doing a Swords and Sorcery book. And he said, well, I don't want to go up against you doing a Swords and Sorcery book. I said, let's do a Swords and Sorcery book together. And I got to say, the actual book I'm really happy with, but that's how that happened. Whereas the book I just handed in, which is a young adult book of witch stories called Under My Hat, that's going to come out in Halloween of next year, that one was literally, I was reading a Terry Pratchett book, a Tiffany Aching book, and I was completely into these sort of characters, witches. And then I looked up at my two daughters, who at the time were dressed up as young witches, and I thought, I really want to do a book for them. And that was the kind of click for it, you know, that I would do something that would work for them. So yeah, it just comes from reading and getting little bits of spark and inspiration out of that, I think.
So something you have a personal connection with. Is that what happened with... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, what you're saying?
I was saying, is that how the cyberpunk anthology, because you got one of those in the works as well, right, for 2012?
You happen to have picked, actually, The Odd Duck Out.
Okay. How come?
He does that.
Well, because that's the one that I don't have the personal connection to particularly. I was actually asked by the publisher if I'd do that one. Normally, in fact, almost exclusively when I get to the point of actually doing a book, it's come out of some personal spark. And I've been working with with the publisher, Nightshade, for a long time, and we're great friends. And we're talking about different projects. And they said, would you like to do we'd like someone to do a cyberpunk book. And I kind of went, sure, yeah, I can do that. Thinking, I mean, I read Neuromancer when it came out in 1984 or 1985. Loved the book. I've done a book with Bruce Sterling and all that kind of thing, so I have some connection to it. But I have to say, that particular one, not my idea.
You mentioned Nightshade. They sent me the Best Science Fiction and Fantasy of the Year, Volume 5. My brain always works like, how do you pick who goes into that volume?
Okay. The simplest way of looking at it is I pick who I remember at the end of the year, if that doesn't sound too ridiculous. First of all, I have to get it finished by set time, so that's another issue. But I start reading generally in November of the year before for the year that we're in. So I started reading November of last year for this year's best, the one I'm working on right now. And I have a group of people who blog as Not If You Were the Last Short Story on Earth, who I read with. And we have an ongoing, they read all the stories that are published. I read them too. We all score them and cross, communicate with one another about what's getting different kind of feel. And we score them. That forms a rough list. I go through that. And the ones that I think are the best, the most interesting, the most exciting, I mean, that's what you're looking for. I try not to over-intellectualize it, I guess. I know I need a certain amount of core science fiction, a certain amount of core fantasy, a fuzzy area in the middle. And all the stories have to be ones which excited me in some way. And that's really as simple as I try to keep it.
Do you ever send one in and say, okay, I can move on now, this one's done, and then you find something and go, oh, dang it, I forgot to put that one in?
Oh, absolutely. Or in some cases, I mean, there was one year where I think it was Tor.com couldn't get me the year-end stories because I deliver well before the end of the year. I mean, last year was the later delivery, but I've delivered as late as a week or two before World Fantasy, so about October 15. Hmm. So when we were in an exclusively print world, everything was done by then. It was easy to get hold of everything. But with online, I mean, I know that, in fact, last year, Tor did a steampunk stuff week, and they had new steampunk stories going up in the Christmas week. And I'd been unable to get a hold of these stories, unable to see them, and so I couldn't consider them for the year's best. It was just sort of one of those things. And that's happening more as online fiction becomes prevalent because they've got such a short lead time.
Jonathan, I love short fiction, and when I talk to some of my buddies who aren't really hardcore science fiction fans, but when I tell them about short fiction, they tend to say, I don't like reading short fiction because the stories aren't long enough. They start getting into them and then they're over. So is there anything you can do or what do you tell people like that you want to bring into short fiction and show them all the wonderful stuff that's there?
I guess what I'd say to them is this, that I understand the attraction of immersive fiction a great deal, but what short fiction offers you is the most intense version of what our field has to offer. It's a little bit like taking the LSD of science fiction, I guess. It's a short, sharp, intense version of things. And I find that amazingly attractive. The other thing that I would say to them is it's that chance to really broaden your own palate really quickly. I mean, what I've had an anthology change my entire reading view of science fiction at one or two occasions in the past. So to come to short fiction, and read it for what it is, to enjoy that intense, sharp change and the ability to move on to something else. That's its great joy.
That's pretty good. I also tell them that if you leave a story wanting more, that's a good story. I mean, that's it. I mean, what else do you want?
Right. Well, absolutely. It's not necessarily about sating your entire appetite, which is not in itself a bad thing. I mean, but you also, I think, can get a lot from having a variety in what you read. I love reading fantasy short fiction, and I love reading George Martin's Game of Thrones, but they're very different beasts, and they fill a different niche in my reading life, and I imagine they would for anybody else.
I always call anthologies, you know, filled with short fiction, they're kind of like a mixtape.
It
gives you a nice little sampling, and, you know, if James Aang is in there and you like his story, then you might go out and seek out more of James Aang's work.
The other thing I'd say is that if you have a well-constructed anthology or collection, they can be their own kind of immersion. You know, sure. Because you can actually be pulled into the flow of the book if it's done well. Also, it's something to switch up. I mean, if you talk to a writer who writes novels or writes short stories, they'll tell you, oh, I write short stories in between, whatever. You can read your novel, you can get into a short story, and you can read it all before bedtime on a long day. You know, it's just a way of switching up and something different.
Well,
and
you can also read it on your commute.
Very much. I mean, I read in coffee shops, I read wherever I might be. I think the other thing is that it is still, to some degree, where the field experiments the most. So, you know, if you want to have some experience of what's being done, what's new and fresh in the field, it's the best way to do it. Read short fiction. Read some of these, you know, read the magazines, read the books, read the websites, and they will reward you greatly, I think.
I think that pretty much sums it up. What anthologies have shaped your own reading and editing career?
The first one, I mean, in chronological order, roughly, Robert Silverberg's Science Fiction Hall of Fame was very important at one point to me, just because I was growing up reading the Golden Age stuff, and also I was given a copy of one of the Asimov Hugo books, one that had Jack Vance's Last Castle in it. That was an important book. I think probably the most formative one, though, was a not terribly widely known book called Light Years and Dark that was edited by Michael Bishop for Berkeley Books back in about mid-1980s. I'd say about 84, roughly, I think. And that suddenly, because of where I live and how books flow, there were all these authors I wasn't aware of. So suddenly, for the first time in one book, I read Bishop himself. I read Kate Wilhelm, Howard Waldrop, George Alec Effinger, a whole bunch of people. And that just completely changed what I was reading. It was how I was introduced to Gardner Dozois, the short story writer, through two brilliant stories, Morning Child and Dinner Party, as opposed to, you know, sort of through his editing. It was also where I first encountered Gene Wolfe. There's a fantastic story in the book called The Map, I think it was. So just an amazing anthology that changed my reading. And I guess less so of late. And Dozois' own year's best were really fundamental as well, because he had that philosophy of dropping his book into an isolated place and you'd be able to extrapolate the entire field from it. That's why it was such a big book. And when you were living in Perth, Western Australia in the mid-1980s, when his book started to come out, you know, most of this American science fiction wasn't available in Australia. I think by 85 we were only catching up to the early 70s, it felt like. And there would be the odd sort of mail order place, because of course there was no internet, so you're unaware. And I remember the local bookshop opened up. It was for a specialist bookstore. Out came this panoply, this array of books. And I remember they would get one monthly shipment from America, and there would be dozens and dozens and dozens of people there helping them process and unpack the boxes. I mean, unpaid labor, just so they could get a look at these books and start like, oh, I've got to have that one, I've got to have that one, I've got to have that one. And it was just, and the Dozois book was like that. It was sort of, I remember particularly the first one, because again, there was that sort of, we were in the post-New Wave, getting into the cyberpunk period. The first Year's Best has I think it's Hardfought by Greg Behrend off the top of my head, which is a fantastic hard SF story, but also Sterling and that whole crowd in, and was just brilliant. So those books, those were the anthologies that really set the mark for me at the time.
Have you ever had a story that you just absolutely loved, but you couldn't get it into one of your anthologies?
All the time. Oh. Happens all the time for various reasons. This last couple of years have been the 2 years of broken books. I couldn't get The Things by Peter Watts into Eclipse 3. And in a perfect world, that's where it belongs. It was written for me, and I accepted the story, but for various reasons, we couldn't run it. And that's both an ongoing sort of sadness for me and a joy for me that I see it on the Hugo ballot. Yeah. There's been a couple of stories that I wanted to put into the year's best that I couldn't get for contractual reasons, and that was disappointing. And then there's a couple of stories that were actually written for my book Life on Mars that, you know, the publisher and I ultimately agreed sort of weren't aimed at the young adult market enough, so they were placed elsewhere in other books of mine. So yeah, it happens. It's a pragmatic negotiation with publishers and stuff, but it's always disappointing when it happens.
Sure. You mentioned Gardner, so there's him, there's Ellen Datlow, there's John Joseph Adams, there's David Hartwell and Catherine Kramer. So these are your these are your editing peers, right? And between all of you and others who I too numerous to mention, of course. But there's so many anthologies for readers to choose from, but it's not really a competition amongst you, is it? I mean, it's all quite nice and. I mean, so when you guys see each other at cons and stuff, what's that interplay between each of you?
Most of us are good friends. I mean, I'm good friends with Gardner and Ellen and with David. I don't know John very well, unfortunately, but he seems like a nice chap. And we tend to be very collegial, I think. You know, there's no point in, there's very little that we do that's actually competitive, if you think about it. Sometimes pitching a book, I guess, but I mean, that's just an individual thing. And very rarely getting an author to write for you, but that's part of the challenge of doing the job, I guess. So yeah, I mean, in fact, what I've tried to do, I mean, like I've done a book, done books with Gardner, as you'd be aware. And we're, I'm looking to do, Ellen and I are trying to do a book together at the moment. We're good friends. So it's not a competitive, who's that person over there sort of staking out my turf.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's fine.
Is there like a philosophy or an approach that or an understanding of approaches that you each have? Like, there's some overlap between all the year's best. There's an occasional overlap here and there, mm-hmm. but by and large, there's not much, right? So, I mean, is there an approach that you think each of you have to approaching editing an anthology?
To editing anthology, I'm not sure. When it comes to the year's best, it's a different answer. And the answer simply is that a good anthology editor is, and it's the best way I can put it, it's the next level up from being a reader and then going on to becoming an informed reader. It's your personal taste. And I've said with other friends of mine, if you were to take the somewhere between 3 and 10,000 original stories that are published as science fiction and fantasy every year, and you were to get all of the year's best editors to read all of those stories and then debate them, we would all come up with the same top 100 stories or 150 stories and be in complete agreement. We just would never agree about the top 20. Because that's where it goes from being a qualitative assessment to being a personal assessment. We all agree this story is good, but I love that one. And I do. I look at the people that I would consider my peers, like Gardner. I mean, he's got a particular taste for straight science fiction. You've got Hartwell and Kramer, who are looking for particular core field values. You've got Horton, who's bringing in sort of a younger demographic and a more I don't want to say arty demographic. That's the wrong way to put it, but a different feel to it. And then I'm trying to sort of do what I do. So yeah, that's a particular way of doing that. So do we have a different way to doing an anthology? I don't think so. I think that there are only so many physical ways to approaching an anthology. You come up with an idea, you approach writers, you put the book together. And I've not talked to David about it, but certainly Gardner and Ellen and I do it in pretty similar ways, I think.
Why don't you tell us about the Coot Street podcast? That's a fantastic podcast for science fiction fans to listen to. It's eminently listenable. Listening to you and Gary K. Wolf talk about science fiction is just it's just a lot of fun. Tell us about how that got started.
It got started because Charles Brown died, I guess, is the simplest way of looking at it. I'd been nagging Charles for a long time to do a podcast because I'd been listening to one that I liked and I thought it'd be fun to chat with him and other people about science fiction. But generally what happened was I would call Charles every week and we'd natter about anything, quite often anything but science fiction. And then he died. And Gary and I had also been talking every week pretty much. And we started to chat like just every week. We're talking about what had happened to Charles, what we felt about the field. And it was really just that whole way of dealing with our friend's death, I guess. And one week I just thought, oh, no, that's right. What had happened was other friends of ours had started this podcast, Galactic Suburbia, that you might have heard of. And they just made it seem like it's easy. Well, if they're doing a podcast, how hard can it be? So I did a couple of little kind of tests to see if I could do an audio recording. And then I just said to Gary one morning, sort of, hey, Gary, let's do a podcast. And he went, sure. And we literally recorded it then. And like the first one was put up on the 8th of May. So you're talking to me on the anniversary of the recording of the first Coot Street podcast. Wow. Right now.
Wow.
And literally we just kind of went, okay. And then I rather foolishly went, because it was totally unconsidered, I rather foolishly said in the blog post that went with it, we'll probably do this every week or two. And then we went the next week and said, well, we better do it. And then sort of after a little while, we're going, okay, we're just doing it. And it's always been, I mean, I realize it's sort of almost something we almost brag about in a weird way. We never rehearse. We never think about it. We never consider. There are no notes taken. We literally just fire. I get him on Skype and we just talk. The only thing, and this is a good thing actually, because we'd natter about all kinds of things. We do have to talk about science fiction. So that keeps us with a little bit of a focus because we know. And the first time when sort of I think we realized we were getting out to people a little bit was there was a weekend where we didn't record on Saturday morning for some reason. I forget why. And the podcast went up about 18 hours late. And people were like twittering, where's the podcast? You know, it's like, it hasn't happened. And you were kind of going, what? Because we weren't following, you know, there was no statistics set up for anything. So we had no idea whether anyone was listening at all. And so you're just sort of firing it out into the ether for the fun of it. And a couple of times we've thought about slicking it up in retrospect, just kind of going, well, now that there are however many people listening to it, maybe we should be a bit more professional and all this. But, you know, we're never going to be, because the whole point about it is it takes as long to record as you hear it go for, and it's online within 15 minutes afterwards kind of thing. And if it ever became work, I think we'd stop. What it is, it's just fun and chatting, and we get it wrong sometimes. And I think somebody suggested a slogan for it. Was it Coot Street? Always certain, often correct. And that's probably about the size of it. You know, it's just us chatting. So I have to say,
yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, it is frankly kind of surreal as well to know that a bunch of people listen to it. Gary and I talk about it often. You know, it's just us. What are they listening to? I wouldn't listen to it. Why would you listen to that?
You can tell that it's friends chatting. One of the things that, you know, whenever we have anybody on Functional Nerds and John and Elon and I get to talking, we goof off a lot. We talk before, then we record, then we talk after. And, you know, we always have people saying, you could tell you guys, you're friends. It's just the way talk, you know? And so that comes through in your podcast. I really enjoyed the episode where you had Farah and Tansy on.
The Diana Wynne Jones correction.
Yes.
That one.
Yes, because I mean there was so much good information in that episode.
Mm, yeah. Well, actually, that one kind of intimidates me in retrospect a little bit and makes me think about another friend of mine's podcast, I think called Bad Film Diaries, where a friend of ours who's a playwright actually reviews films and he scripts the whole thing. The whole 30 minutes is written. It's really information dense and brilliant. And I know that Gary and I ramble, and I know that it's sometimes not very information dense at all. And I kind of think, this coming week we'll talk about this, and I'm gonna actually prepare. But there just isn't the time in life to do that.
I used to script every episode of Functional Nerds when we first started. Yeah. I created a script. I would send it to John. We'd have something to talk back and forth on, and that lasted like 2 episodes. And then we just said, "Screw this! It's too much work. Let's just talk."
Yeah. Well, so there's a podcast that I listen to, you may or may not be aware of it, called This American Life. And plainly, it's journalists working full time. And when I listen to things like that, I become aware of how much preparation you could do and you should do if this was the one main thing you did.
Right.
And I'd really, on one hand, I'm really attracted to the idea. I'd love to do it. But, you know, as long as it's sort of done in my study in a spare hour and a bit every week, the family can bear it. If I were sitting there going, well, what's coming up? Let me read an extra book. Let me research it and make notes, and I'll go in, I'll be fully sort of involved, then I think it would die. And the other thing is, I suspect that for our listeners in some way, it's as good to know what we don't know as what we do know. I think it's nice to know that people who are supposedly well-informed about something don't know everything.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, I've had chats with, say, John Clute, and John Clute knows so much more about science fiction than I will ever know. I mean, seriously, he perspires more than I know about science fiction. And yet,
I used to think I was well-read until I met Karen Burnham.
Yeah.
And now I feel like I'm adult.
I spent 10 years talking to Charles Brown every Saturday morning. Mm-hmm. Karen Burnham doesn't know anything compared to Charles. I mean, he remembered every story he'd ever read.
Wow.
Dating back to the late 40s, early 50s.
And that brings me to, I mean, as much as we love the podcast, and everybody should go listen to the podcast, we would be absolutely remiss if we did not mention Locus.
Absolutely. It's been a source of joy and frustration for me since I joined. How long ago is that now? 14 years ago. I've been with Locus pretty much about 14 years now.
Wow.
Started off as Charles indulging his managing editor, who is now my wife. Charles had no interest in me on Earth, none at all. But he gave me a job so that my wife and I could be together. So I flew out from Australia and I worked in his basement shifting boxes. Hmm. And became friends, and I became a reviewer, and then ultimately the reviews editor of the magazine. And it's been a ride. It's been really awesome, actually. It's a great place to work.
John? Oh, John.
Sorry, I was on mute. I don't know what it is with me and the mute button. So for folks who don't know what the job of a review editor is like, why don't you walk us through a typical, I don't want to say day, but, month.
Cycle.
A cycle, yeah. Locus publishes monthly. Oh, and please talk about the digital edition, because that's fantastic. I love having it on the first day of the month. Great. Love it. Go ahead.
Okay. The review cycle basically turns over a three-month period from when we become aware of a book and get a copy of it. My job is to, in collaboration with the editor-in-chief, Liza Tromby, look through all of the books that are being published in the field and decide which ones look as though they're going to be of interest to the magazine, get copies of those books. I then talk to the review staff that we have, and we've got 10 people or so on staff that we use, maybe 12, I think it is, and then work out who would be interested in reviewing those books, because we do have a philosophy that we're not going to get somebody to review a book up front that they're not interested in reading. And then I actually get the reviews. The reviews are sent to me. I do all the editing on them. They go into the magazine. It's fairly simple. And so it's about a three-month cycle, because right now I think I've just done the June reviews or the July reviews. So yeah. And the big change, and I have to say, the hats off here have to go almost exclusively to Liza Tromby, because Charles talked about it off and on for, 5 or 10 years and could never work it out. There was always talk about doing a digital edition of Locus in some way, and we always backed away from it, I guess, because it was just complicated. But Liza pushed through, and it's been the best thing in the world for Locus, I think. You know, starting with the January issue this year, you can now buy and download a PDF or an EPUB or a MOBI file or whatever you want of Locus, and I think it's hard for someone associated closely with Locus to admit it. I think Locus was risking becoming less relevant to the modern science fiction field because it took too long to get a hold of it. I mean, the magazine would be printed and bound and ready to go out at the end of a month, and people wouldn't see it maybe for a couple of weeks, or in some cases 6 or 8 weeks. And now that we live in an internet universe where, if there's a piece of news, you've heard it in 20 minutes. That really wasn't working, and people were turning away from Locus as a source for considered news and worthwhile reviews. And now that it comes out digitally, I mean, I see it happen. I mean, I get it digitally sent to me at the same time everybody else does. And I see something, people popping up on Twitter going, I've got my Locus. It's really great. I can read it. It's current now. And I think what Liza did intentionally but effectively was to save the magazine. I think, sort of subscriptions, I think, are going up as a result, which is an enormously positive thing. People seem to be talking positively about the magazine, which is great. And we're continuing to look for to find ways to keep it fresh and relevant to the field, because as much as it was designed as a tool to shape the field, it also is there to reflect the field as well. And so it's good to know the field's engaging with it the way it is now, and that readers are finding it more accessible. I think it's really important. So yeah, I think it's just been very exciting.
Absolutely.
I'll tip my hat too. My own personal experience was pretty much what you said. I was I had ordered Locus, and I would get it extremely late, and it would be open, and the pages would be like dog-eared. I think someone in my postman was reading it, or I don't know, someone in between me and Locus. And ultimately, I canceled my subscription because I would get it late, and I'd never get around to reading it. But when they went digital, I signed up. I said I'll have it on the first of the month, and it's been an outstanding experience, and I highly recommend Locus. It's a if you want the daily stuff, there's Locus Online you can go to, or locusmag.com, but the magazine itself has these really insightful interviews and reviews, and it's just a hoot to read. Highly recommend it.
Yeah, I do. I think they refreshed it beautifully. I mean, it's done by Liza with Tim Pratt, who does the layout for it. And of course, one thing, I mean, this is a great discussion about ebooks generally, is the whole thing that becomes an entire separate editorial process. And I don't know to what extent, have either of you ever actually been to the offices of Locus?
No.
No, not me.
Okay. Basically, it's half a dozen people working out of a house. And so it's a very small, sort of physical resource for them to draw on. So to be producing, in effect, almost two parallel magazines was a very demanding thing for them to consider doing. And I think it's been enormously rewarding. And I think there'll probably always be a print magazine, because that's the nature of what Locus is. But the fact that people have responded so positively, is just the best thing. And it gives me hope that it will be able to continue on its ongoing mission to shape and reflect the field.
Yeah. One of the key technologies that is developing now is the ability to take content and either publish it traditionally or publish it electronically, not having to do, two separate paths. And I think as that grows, I mean, that's something that I have a software developer that works with me who is building that right now for a local company, mm-hmm. where essentially you go into a web interface, you create your content, and then it saves it, and then you say, do you want to print this on paper or do you want to print this to the web?
Yeah.
And that is the key, because then it like you said, they have a finite amount of resources, but if they can have, where they just create the content once, and then they can click a button and say, we need the digital version or we need the print version, that's where the power is going to be.
Yeah, very much, very much. I mean, and it's all about reaching out to people in the way they want to be spoken to.
Yes.
And it helps to build community, and I think Locus it has been changing its philosophy on community a great deal over the last 5 years. When I joined Locus, it was sort of the secret bunker in the hills of Oakland. And now I think it's a much more open, accessible thing, and that's going to continue, which is really exciting and good. So, yeah.
It is.
And if you love science fiction, then having that debate, and that's just what the podcast is about, it's what the Year's Best are about. It's all about having a discussion about science fiction on some level or other in different ways, particularly if you're as isolated as you can be. I mean, I'm here in Perth, Western Australia, which, should you ever fly here, is at the end of the earth. And I know you guys are in different locations across the United States. And I mean, when we did the Diana Wynne Jones podcast for Coot Street, we had somebody in London, we had me in Perth, we had Tansy in Tasmania, we had Gary in Chicago, and we could do that very easily. And that just lets us engage and talk more, which is, it makes it a much more interesting experience, though it could all slow down a bit too.
So we promised that we would only keep you about 30 minutes, so we're kind of pushing that time limit now. Why don't you tell folks what you've got coming out, where they can find you online, Twitter, Facebook, your website, all that kind of good stuff.
Sure. Well, I guess what I've got coming out, in fact, is what's just out. I have a young adult science fiction anthology called Life on Mars, which just came out from Penguin Viking. I have Eclipse 4, which just came out literally in the last few days from Nightshade Books and should be in all good bookstores. And Engineering Infinity, which came out from Solaris Books just in January. I should have a new Jack Vance collection of mystery novels that I've edited with Terry Dowland coming out from Subterranean Press later this year, and also I hope, if I can get myself organized, a Best of Joe Haldeman later this year. So that will be everything that I'll have out for year 2011. You can find me online at jonathanstrand.com.au. You can find me on Twitter as Jonathan Strand, so I'm fairly consistent and simple. And funnily enough, on Facebook, just the same way. So I'm around and about, and I'm talking about what I do, and I love to hear from people and know what people think about stuff. So, yeah, and I hope, if the world turns super kindly, I hope to be in Reno, Nevada for Worldcon, because, you know, I love Worldcon. It's always fun. And I also hope to be in San Diego for World Fantasy, which is my favorite convention on Earth. I consider it my local convention. So, yeah, that's where I am and where I can be found. And I would love to hear from anybody.
I agree with you on World Fantasy. That was a great convention. Also, you know, you do the Locust stuff. You have the podcast.
Yes.
You have all these anthologies coming out. You're such a slacker.
You know, the funny thing is that people always look at me strangely when I say that I'm both shy and lazy. But it's true. I sit there all the time going, you should be doing more. Why aren't you doing this? And some of it does spin up very quickly and unexpectedly. You know, I once sold 3 anthologies over a beer on Charles's back deck and then suddenly realized I had to do them. You know, so...
You know, I hear all these tales. You know, Lou Anders is a friend of the podcast. And it seems like every time someone tells me about the deal where they made, you know, to work on a book, or they're writing a book, or they're working on it, was at a bar or around a beer.
And, you know, that it tells you a lot about how our field really works. You know, it's where our inhibitions are low, and we can sort of talk casually, and then somebody goes, that sounds like fun. We could do that. Let's do that.
Beer, you know, it's fueling science fiction.
It's beer o'clock. And, you know, and it's all about the forward momentum, you know, sort of just diving in and doing it. I hear and I sort of admire people who plan all the things that they do, but I've never planned anything. I've just sort of, that sounds fun, let's do that. That sounds fun, let's do that. And sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't, you know. And you end up with a podcast with some people listening to it, and I've, you know, a long relationship with a magazine. I've just done, and I only know this because I had to look it up, you know, I've done 42 books in the last 7 years.
Wow.
You know, and that's just pushing ahead, so, you know.
I think I've read 42 books in the last 7 years.
Oh, that's the great loss of my life. The great loss of my life is reading novels. Hmm. I mean, I started reading for the year's best in late 2002. And since then, my novel reading has declined dramatically. I mean, once upon a time, and I looked this up, tells you what kind of a nerd I am. I looked it up, and it used to be that I would have read 75 or 80% of the Hugo and Nebula nominated novels. Now I'm reading a sixth, usually, because I just don't have time. So,
yeah, I remember on one of the episodes, you and Gary were talking about, was it Game of Thrones? You've read the first one, but you've never read any of the other books?
That's right, yes. I had to read the third one for the World Fantasy Awards, because I was a judge in 2002. And I mean, I love Game of Thrones. It's a great book. I really loved it. And I wanted to read the others, but I just didn't have time. And the third one's unreadable without the second one. Mm-hmm. From what I could tell. So, and yeah, that happens all the time. And I literally have these decisions. Like, a book comes in, you know, comes to the house, and I look at it and I go, am I going to read this now, or will I never read it again? And I look at it and I go, okay, I'm busy, and I'll set it aside, and that means that I will never read it again. Mm. Because it's 2011 now. We're in fact, here at my house, it's probably about November of 2011 reading-wise. I will be reading 2012 by July, I would say. And I can't go back to any of the 2011, you know, the 2010 books that are sitting over there that look interesting. So,
wow. Well, I better wrap this up. Otherwise, I'm going to let you talk for another 2 hours. So, we've got the websites, you got the Twitter, Facebook, you got your conventions. Everybody should just, you know, drop you a line. They should check out the podcast. And
they can find
it
on iTunes,
Yeah, and we want to thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure. I listen to your podcast all the time, so I'm delighted to be here.
Awesome.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Jonathan.
Okay. No worries.
And there you have it, our interview with Jonathan Strahan. Thank you so much, Jonathan, for coming on. We had a lot of fun, as you can tell, because we started our podcast the way that Jonathan and Gary start the Coot Street podcast, which is just, you know, good morning. So that's what that was all about and why there was no music there in the beginning. Hopefully you enjoyed this podcast as much as we enjoyed having Jonathan on and interviewing him. Feel free to leave us comments on the post or shoot us a voicemail with any thoughts, 720-277-9082, or use the Google widget to have Google call you. If you did enjoy this podcast, there's a couple things you can do for us. You can go to iTunes, search for SF Signal, and on our page, give us a couple stars or write us a review. Tell people what you think. That helps to boost our signal within the iTunes podcast directory. Also, you can tell a couple friends, you know. Just tell people, hey, I'm listening to this podcast. It's pretty interesting stuff. You should check it out. We appreciate that. Check out sfsignal.com each and every day. John D. usually has something scheduled to go up, either a column from one of our regulars, a mind meld, maybe a video or two. There's always something going on over at sfsignal.com, so you want to check that out, you know, often, put it in your reader, all that kind of good stuff. To get daily, sometimes hourly, updates, follow John D. on Twitter, twitter.com/sfsignal, and he tweets all kinds of stuff. Good stuff there, too. If you're looking for me online, I appreciate that. I'm at twitter.com/ATFMB, which is all things from my brain. That's also my blog, all things from my brain, www.atfmb.com. You should also listen to the Functional Nerds. We've got some good stuff going on in that podcast, functionalnerds.com. I think that's pretty much it for me. It is Sunday morning. It's a dreary, cold Sunday morning. My nose is all stuffed up, and my coffee's getting cold. So I think I'm out of here until next week. Until then, have a great, great week. Bye.